Welcome back to Good Dirt, conversations with leaders in real estate and beyond. It's been a few weeks now since we released our conversation with John Fish of Suffolk, and we were really thrilled with the market's response and how far and wide that episode reached. So thanks so much to all of you who reached out to Tommy and I with feedback, and also those of you who shared it with friends, colleagues, and clients.
Today's conversation is with another very well-known figure in the real estate market, both locally and on a national basis. Peter Merrigan, the Chief Executive Officer of Torrest Investment Holdings, LLC. Torrest is a global real estate private equity firm established in 1997 and headquartered here in Boston, Mass. Torrest focuses on strategic investments into value-add, core plus, opportunistic, and development opportunities. As CEO and a member of the firm's investment committee, Peter defines and guides Torrest in executing investment strategies in multifamily, industrial, office, mixed use, in the renewable energy sectors across the U.S. and internationally. Peter has overseen the acquisition and development of more than 70 million square feet of commercial space to date, with a value in excess of nearly $11 billion.
Peter tells his story from the beginning with his entrance into the real estate business with one of Boston's most notable land assemblages at Assembly Square, and that was a classic covered land play, as you'll hear about. And he brings us through the evolution of Torrest into today, its position as a really well-known global investor. Lots of interesting threads here. Tommy mentioned the renewable energy sectors, which is pretty fascinating and eye-opening to me. The growth of the platform over time, both in terms of talent and assets under management, and a lot of fun anecdotes from Peter, which will be interesting to all of you in the market.
It's been really great to see what Peter's built, and we have some great friends who we talk about over at Torrest who have helped him, and I, from a multifamily perspective, have really enjoyed watching them grow that business line. It's pretty incredible how much of a player they are. So we appreciate Peter sharing his story and the Torrest story with our Good Dirt community, and we hope you'll enjoy it as well. So enjoy.
As always, please share far and wide with others who may find these interviews interesting. We have a great lineup this spring, which we're really excited about. We've been pretty busy here at the Newmark podcast studio, if you will. So make sure you subscribe and share it freely. Thank you very much.
Enjoy.
All right, welcome back to Good Dirt, conversations with leaders in real estate and beyond. Today, we are thrilled to have in the Newmark offices, Peter Merrigan, CEO of Torrest Investment Holdings. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So we've known Peter for a long time, and we've been involved with Torrest in a number of projects over the years. I think Torrest fits into the category of platforms that maybe if you sit in Boston and you work in the Boston market, you may not appreciate the breadth at which you guys are deploying capital and investing, not only around the country, but I think across three continents at this point. So there's a lot to cover today. We're looking forward to delving into all that. Peter, maybe if you could just kick us off with an overview of Torrest, and then we'll step back and talk about how this all started.
So this version of Torrest, which is completely separate from the original version, has been around since 97. Torrest is based in Boston still. We really founded it here. And Torrest had two lives. My two original partners, Lawrence and Gunther Reibling, had another company that they founded in Munich called Torrest Investment Group in the 70s. And then they were 20 years older than me. I wasn't, I was still in grade school in the 70s. But we met in the 90s and we got rid of that company and formed Torrest Investment Holdings in 1997. And we've grown it. We bootstrapped it over the years. And we get into a little history of how that happened. But we've grown it into 140 employees. We have offices throughout the United States, and we're in the UK, based in London. We have a pretty large office in Munich. We do a lot of investment in Germany, and then we have a pretty significant operation in India as well. From a capital formation standpoint, a lot of our capital flow comes from the Middle East. I spend a lot of time in Israel and Saudi Arabia and places like that, UAE. And then we have a significant amount of European and South American capital as well. And then we do have a U.S. capital base also. It's a fairly diversified business from both a capital formation standpoint and from an operational standpoint. We've done probably, I guess, about $11 billion of investing over the years. And what makes us a little different is historically, we've done what we call the club deal business. And we've done since 97, I think we're closing on club deal 261 in the series in March. So it's just ongoing. There are individual offerings, Reg D offerings that we do. They can be quite large. Smallest size one would be probably in, say, $25 to $30 million range. That would be the smallest. And then some of the larger ones can be upwards of $600, $700 million in size. And we pool the investors together in these offerings, and then we place them through our investment channels around the world.
What's the nature of those investors in the club deals? Is that family offices? Is it institutions? A little bit of everything?
It's a little bit of everything. We'll team up with a number. We have a lot of institutional relationships that we joint venture with. You know, household names who I'm sure you guys interact with every day. If we have a strategy that they like or a deal that they like, then we'll work with them. People like TPG, who we do a fair amount with. PGIM, we've done a lot with in Europe. We've worked with Apollo and BlackRock and, you know, the list goes on and on. Kayne Anderson is a big partner of ours, Aegon. But our club deal investors, if you would, that is kind of our bread and butter business, which is about a $500 million a year placement business of equity, that is family offices. And that's done through private banks and through other channels that we've established around the world. So the way we've always looked at it, when you're deploying $500 million a year, and we don't do that every year because last year we didn't do that much. Last year was a slow year for everybody. And our volume was down probably half of that, $250 million. But when the machine's running and it's running properly, you know, in 21, 22, et cetera, and before that, then you're doing $500 million a year. You're leveraging that, say, two-thirds, so $1.5 billion of investments. And it's sort of like having a $1 billion fund at your disposal with a 24-month investment period. So that's how we look at it. Just to finish on that topic, if you're in my business or my seat, the reason why you find that kind of attractive, the other people in the private equity business will realize there's no cross-promote. Every deal stands on its own, lives or dies on its own. If you can do it at scale, it's the best way to do business. It took us a long time to build that platform of capital formation and investment relations, and it's really hard to duplicate, but it's a really great way to do business.
And you've built a juggernaut. You've done 260 deals, you said, and it's $500 million a year. We'll get back to Taurus, but how have you found that capital raise in this environment? Is that more challenging, the kind of more retail through private banks, or has that become easier in this world that we're living in for you?
So we've been doing this a long time. We have a long track record. People know us in that sector. Very, very sticky relationships. We put a lot of customer service in. We talk to people all the time. You know, a lot of handholding with the client base. We have a big IR team that manages all the various relationships. I spend a lot of time on the road meeting people individually. If the deals are right and the opportunities are right for what that client is looking for, the money's there. These are extremely wealthy people. The average check size per deal is about $800,000 per investor. So this isn't retail syndication. This is ultra high net worth business. It's a very hard market to penetrate. But once you're in there and you don't screw it up, it's pretty good. Yeah.
You must meet some interesting people.
Most of our clients are worth over $500 million and they didn't inherit it, most of them. Yeah. You know, they earned it. So they're super smart. You're not going to pull anything over on them. They come from incredible backgrounds and they're industrialists in Germany and princes in Saudi Arabia. They probably inherited the money. Then technology people in Israel and, you know, all sorts of different folks. Really very, very high levels of society that we interact with on a daily basis. They're super interesting.
Very cool. We could spend an hour talking about your investors because I bet there's some incredible characters on that list.
If you look at our board, our advisory board, they're all people who are investors of ours and who have a real vested stake in Taurus and it's in the platform and have been working with me forever. And they all are incredibly successful people in their own right. They're an advisory board because they give me a lot of advice. They know exactly what they're doing. They're really smart people that have had all kinds of different experiences in venture capital and private equity and healthcare, and they bring their perspective to the table. So yeah, you can learn a lot if you can listen to these clients. One thing about my business is the client is always smarter than me. So it's good. It pays off to
whether,
be a good,
whether
to be
they
a good
are,
listener.
They aren't. Whether they are or they aren't, they're smarter than you. And you've built out an impressive team across the board. We're going to talk about some of those individuals in particular, but when you're doing that many club deals alongside your separate account business, you have a big investor relations function that you've built out within Taurus with our friend Dave Visco. I know he's a big member of that team. And he's a good friend of the Greeleys and the podcast. I think there's 6 or 7 folks in your IR team. Are they traveling all over the world? Are they focused more on domestic club deals? How does that whole function work?
One of our guys is in Riyadh today. I'm going down to Santiago, Chile with Dave Visco next month. And he covers the Chile market. Yeah. We have more than 6 or 7 people. We got quite a few more than that. We have an entire team in Renana and outside, that we work with on a third-party basis in Israel. We have a very large private bank that we work with, one of the largest in Saudi that sources our product, and they have a whole sales team that has probably dozens of people involved. Right. And so we go over there and spend time with them. And then in Germany, we have an entirely separate office just for IR dealing with our German investors. Okay. It's a retail business, but it's not retail the way people think about it. It's not like a crowdfunding thing. It's more like a very heavy direct engagement with the client.
Yeah, and most of those family offices that we've seen, once they trust a partner and once they're sort of in the flow, that can be, as you know, a 30-plus year relationship.
And they are. The way that the business started, if we want to get into that a little bit.
Yeah, definitely.
Let's go there.
I met the Reibling brothers who were doing this. The reason we got into this business was because that's what they were doing in Germany. They were two German guys from Munich who had a bunch of incredibly wealthy industrialist families from Germany that wanted to invest in the U.S. through them. And they were basically investing with Tom Alpern over at National Development, doing some deals with him. And I was at the time working at Berkeley Investments with Young Park, and we bought a big chunk of Harold Brown's bankruptcy called the Omnibus portfolio. And I was just out of school. I'd gone to grad school at the real estate program at MIT, and they put that deal together, and Lawrence and Gunther syndicated the equity and with some families from Germany who still invest with us to this day. And then, so what happened was I left there in 97, just wanted to start my own business. I was 30 years old and I figured I knew everything and it was time to go. Didn't realize at the time what I didn't know, which was a lot. But I always wanted to be an entrepreneur and be on my own. I really didn't want to be an employee. And so at that time, it was like, it's a good age to do it. So I went off and I actually tied up a deal, which was a family from Woburn that was sort of in a, let's call it a father and son dispute over buying out their portfolio. So I kind of stepped in and got the contract when I was on my own.
And what kind of a deal is this? Industrial?
It was what we still do today, last mile industrial. Yep. It's our biggest sector. It was in Centennial Park. It was in Woburn, when all that stuff was leasing for $4 or $5 a foot. And then most importantly, there was a major asset in Assembly Square in Somerville. And it was across from the mall. If you look at the partners building that tower, that used to be a single-story industrial building. And that was the key asset in that portfolio that I saw. And I said, okay, if I can buy this, I can buy all of it. Because it's literally, if you threw a dart at Assembly Square, everything touched that building. You were in a butter to everybody, really. So no one could do anything else. And so there were all kinds of guys poking around at the time. Steve Samuels had the site in the back tied up with for Stop and Shop. The mall was going into bankruptcy, and Tom Alpern and was trying to buy it. And there was some other stuff kicking around over the old movie theater was. It was all basically an industrial wasteland. But I remember one thing that Tom Alpern told me at the time, because I was this kid who just was had a contract. He said, oh, you got to see at the table, Peter. You got ball control. You know, we put together a venture to buy them all together. I bought the Sturtevant Street site on my own. Oh, not my own, but with the Reiblings. And then we assembled about 60 acres of Assembly Square, which is now Assembly Row. And that was our first deal. And so what happened was, the problem when you have really ambitious things like that, you get a 7-asset portfolio with a linchpin asset in Assembly Square when you don't have any money, you do need to go out and find some money to buy it. So approached the Reiblings at the time and said, hey, we had a good time together in the Harold Brown portfolio. You want to do it again in this portfolio? And there's actually kind of a funny story about that whole situation where I'll tell you how the nature of the relationship with me and the Reiblings was. I went to dinner at the Four Seasons Aujourd'hui, which is, you know, the old restaurant there. Mm-hmm. And Lawrence was there and he said, and I put this whole package together at Kinko's, you know, with color copies of each building, all these numbers I had run.
We've heard about those days.
Yeah. I mean, you could see the pieces of tape.
Yeah.
Like on the color copy from where I was taping the picture to the deck. And I was so nervous about the whole thing. I needed $7.5 million to buy this portfolio. Lehman Brothers had agreed to give me the financing, but I was basically unfinanceable because I couldn't even sign a carve-out guarantor at the time. I definitely needed some support. Didn't have any money to put down a deposit, didn't have any money to pay lawyers, but I did have a contract, right?
Had ball control, just no
ball
equity.
Control. The Gerdeke guys, the Fowler guys rather, John Fowler, gave me a desk to work at their office, actually in this building, when it was Fowler Gerdeke. And so I had a place to hang my hat, but I didn't have any money. So I talked to the Reiblings. I went to Lawrence. I said, okay, Lawrence, we got to do this deal. I was buying it for an 11 cap. Think about that.
Wow.
Yeah. And we were financing it. 7.5 was the cost of the debt, I think, if I remember right, with Lehman. And they gave us a high proceeds loan. So lots of cash flow. And then a great upside with that assembly piece. You know, I talked to Lawrence about it. This is very typical for Lawrence. He says, Peter, he says, yeah, again, the thing, I said, we'll drive it tomorrow. I'll show you everything. And he said, Peter, do you like the deal? And I said, yeah, this is a great deal. This is as good as or better than the Harold Brown deal. He takes the deck. He never opens it, puts it over on the other side. Okay, we'll do it.
Well, it's back to Mike's earlier point where you have these investors who they keep coming back. The retention's great, and it's because you do a couple good deals, and they trust you, they believe in you, and if you think it's a good deal, then they're in. It's impressive that you earned that trust so quickly.
You must have walked out of there that night, though.
Well, the story's not over. So then I go back home, and I'm like, oh my God, I got my business launched. I got this deal. I'm going to build out Assembly Square. I'm going to be the next big developer in Boston and all this kind of stuff. And Lawrence calls me the next day and says, you know, Peter, can't do it.
Oh, my God.
No way.
The highs and lows.
Unless we form a new Taurus together.
Oh, cool.
And you get rid of your company, we'll get rid of ours. We'll raise the money in Germany, and you're the deal guy in the U.S. And so that's how
the rest is history.
I always say the expression is on that particular point is when you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose.
Right. Well, amen.
I had nothing. So it was like, okay, I guess we'll do that.
I love that. These first sort of early deal stories, especially when people are trying to raise money and you have an opportunity you feel good about, and you have no equity, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, finding that cash. But they make for great real estate stories because you look back, look what happened because of that Four Seasons dinner when he didn't open the book and trusted in you. So I want to pause for a second because at that point, you were equipped to size up a deal, realize what was attractive about it. If we go back a little bit, you went to Holy Cross. What was the early days like? Where did you learn how to get to that point where you could tie up Assembly Square?
I'll go back even a little further if you want. My parents are from Dorchester. They grew up on the same street in Dorchester. And so then we moved to Milton. So I ended up growing up in Milton when I was a kid. And it was great upbringing. I'm the oldest of five. Very driven family. Great work ethic instilled in me by my parents. Ended up going to Milton Academy. It was a private school in Milton. And then during the summers, my dad was a realtor in East Milton Square. He would build a house or two during every year and then sell it. It was part of his business. And I always worked construction, if you want to call it that. I was more like a laborer, but I was doing general laborer stuff. And I think my first time doing it was like 14 in Southie. He was doing a condo deal on East 4th Street. And so I was like sweeping the floors.
Getting dirt in the fingernails.
Yeah, it was great. I always like working on site. I love doing construction, things like that. It was really fun. I still love it. I love being on job sites. I love seeing the guys at work and putting things together. So it was kind of in my DNA from my dad, but I wanted to do it at a much bigger scale. And so I actually never worked for my dad after college. I was like, yeah, that probably won't be the best fit, but I like the business. So I went to Holy Cross. I majored in English. I didn't really know much of anything about business, but I talked to my professors there and he's graduating. He's like, well, do you want to be a lawyer or a teacher or whatever, what all your friends are doing or with your English degree? And I said, no. He said, what do you want to do? I said, well, I like building stuff and I like making money, you know, and I always work all the way through college and part-time jobs and stuff like that. So basically, I had no idea how to break into the business. I didn't have a concept of it, but I got lucky. I met Ed Maher.
Amen. I like
it. Who was my first boss.
Oh, wow.
They told us there was a stint together.
Yeah, yeah.
Were you still in school?
Yes. I hadn't graduated yet. They had an internship I was already graduating, so I was actually looking for a job, not an internship.
It was Woody, Griffin, Marcy at that point?
No, it was this is pre-Woody and Griffin, Marcy. This is Woody, who's the head of research at Coldwell Banker in Wellesley.
Got it.
He was a research director. And Sean McKenna, I don't know if you remember Sean. Sean and he worked together. They were actually employed by the company. And they hired 4 interns. But Woody was kind enough to hire me, even though I was already graduating.
Wow, that is so funny.
And pay me. This is the funny part of that story is that, so I'm all excited, you know, and I got a job, called it a job, you know, it was $5.50 an hour. But they gave me 26 cents a mile to drive my car. So I went out and financed a Ford Escort, and I made all my money putting miles on my car.
I was going to say, yeah. Do a couple laps around the neighborhood.
This is awesome. Yeah, I love that.
So good.
So that was how, Woody doesn't know that I was gaming the system.
Oh,
I was driving
awesome.
My car around with them and putting miles on it.
But, I love that.
So, but the problem was, it was 1989. The market was completely dead and dying. It was getting worse, not better. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't able to break in to the brokerage side, doing what you guys do. And so they weren't hiring at the time. I couldn't get it. But there was some great people there. Mm-hmm. Danny Doherty was in there and Brian Kelly. And Brian Kelly sat behind me in the cube.
And it was Owen Wellesley.
Owen Wellesley,
wow.
Yeah. There was like
what a crew.
Guys who ended up super successful. Corey was there in that office. And Rob was there in the back. He was the kingpin back then. He's still the kingpin, right?
I love it.
That's so many years ago. But I still am friends with all those guys. And we still do deals together. And even for kids breaking into the business, even that first job, as humble as that job may be, and that was a humble job, you can create great relationships that can last your whole life.
And I'll say, thank God you didn't break into the brokerage business.
I know.
Well, sir, yeah. So I consider that being a failure at the time. I was like, oh, I can't make it into this business, and I'm not going to be able to do it. So I ended up renting apartments for the Corcoran family, and then I became a property manager, and I was like, okay, I don't want to do this. I need to make money. I had to get a paycheck, and you know, I was like, all right, I'll be the best apartment rental guy, and I'll be the best property management guy, but it's not really what I want to do. But I didn't have the financial skills, so that's when I decided to go back to MIT, and I applied there. I was fortunate to get in. It was 1992, so—
Is this the real estate program, or is this the
real estate program? The real estate program, yeah. So it was great timing because 92, things were as dead could be. And then 93 is when CMBS starts, the REITs start going. And it was all failures being syndicated by Wall Street, repackaged and sold off. But liquidity was coming back to the market. Sam Zell was doing his deals and on and on. And it was really, really a good time to get break back into the business. And that's why we were able to buy like the Harold Brown portfolio. So my job that I got out of MIT was with Berkeley. Berkeley was going through its own recovery process at the time. And what I learned from those guys, and John Fenton was there, and Chris Nisley, and Mike Orslin, PJ Yateman, all super talented guys who have all done really well in their careers. But we're all in our 20s and just kind of learning it. But we figured out how to do deals, underwrite them, raise money, how to price your business, all that kind of thing. And if you were a good observer, which I've always thought I was pretty good at that, is like listening to people and being a good observer to how people do things and do it well. Now, that's why I had the confidence. I said, okay, I can do this. That's when I took the leap. Sorry it was such a long story, but I guess the point out of this is like every step in that path, while none of it really seems to make a lot of sense, you know, kind of zigzagging around a little bit, you can learn from every step and apply those lessons to create a business.
Yeah, and it's super unique. You fit a lot of tools into the belt from swinging hammers in Southie with your old man when you're a teenager to renting apartments for the Corcorans, property management, and then working with Berkeley. It's unique to hear somebody who had all those different steps along the way. And I think it uniquely equips you to do what you're doing today and to build the business. So I want to go back to Assembly for a second because, you know, a lot of our listeners know Assembly Square as today's Assembly Square. What was it like when you tied it up? And then what was your business plan? Where did you bring it and hand it off to the next group?
First piece was 34th Sturtevant Street, which is a single-story industrial building built in like probably the 1950s, leased to Gray Bar and Paperama. It was kind of a quasi-lousy
Paperama. People are going to love
throwback
that one.
On the corner space.
Our mom was a big customer back in the day.
There was an 80,000-foot bar in it, which people might remember, wow. Good Time Billiards. I think it was the largest bar in Massachusetts.
Wow.
It was a big building. It was like 250,000 feet or something like that. But we paid $1 million an acre for it. I looked at it as a covered land play. I knew there was huge upside. What I always liked about that in the old industrial space is it's so defensible. That's why we still do it. You know, now we own 20 million square feet of the same stuff. But multi-tenant, you can push the rents. I remember the bar came to me. There's a quick story on that. And this guy who ran the bar says, oh, he's up, my lease is up. In the lease was baseball arbitration, which is a pretty unusual concept. And he said, oh, you know, I'm not making any money and I can't afford this. I'm like, 80,000 foot bar. I'm like, you're making money, man.
Right.
So he says, well, I can only pay $4.50 a foot. And I said, well, I think you could pay 11 bucks a foot, which seems like not a lot now, but it was a lot back then. It's a pretty big spread. Well, guess what? He lost and he had to pay 11 bucks a foot.
Oh, my God. I love it.
And he paid it.
There you go.
It seemed he was making money.
There was a little more margin in there than he was sharing.
Yeah. So it was really a lot of upside just in that old building, but that was not the long-term play. The long-term play was to get control of the – so that site was like 8 acres. Got control of the mall, which took about a year and a half, and Tom Alpert and I did that together. And then I got control separately from – that was the only deal we did with National. Everything else we did on our own, and we did the Garrity Oil site, which was adjacent to Sturtevant Street site. And then there was an RFP – so my idea, believe it or not, was to put a train station on this site because I was like, all right, the train's across the river and it goes to Sullivan Square, but it's flat here and it doesn't stop. Look at things kind of simply. It's like, it should stop here and unlock the value of this whole area. So I said, well, the only way I'm going to be able to build a train station here is if I get control of that rail yard that's next to it, which happened to be owned by the city. And Joe Curtatone was not the mayor at this point. It was a different mayor. Actually, it was Mike Capuano originally when I first bought it. He went to Congress, and then Dorothy Kelly Gay was there for a while, and then Joe Curtatone became the mayor. And Joe was really the one who changed everything there. Anyways, we got control of an RFP. It was called Yard 21. So we controlled that, and then we were able to get an eminent domain thing with the Green Cab site and the Central Steel site. When you added all that up together, it ended up being about 60 acres. We had ball control over 60 acres, and they were the most important acres, really, in my opinion. IKEA had come in and bought the site that Steve Samuels originally was going to do at Stop and Shop. Stop and Shop went across the Somerville Lumber site, where they are now. And so there was a whole, I don't want to get into all the discussions we had with endless meetings with all these guys, all these stakeholders that were jockeying for position between IKEA and Stop and Shop and us and Home Depot and all. It's just this big chessboard. I used to actually, when I go to my investor meetings, I would write it up like a chessboard. I said, this is what this group has. This is what their stakes are. And I'd explain it to the German families who were over there just trying to understand what the heck is going on in this site. Really complicated piece of real estate, which, by the way, just talk just for a second about how I raised the money for that. So this is in the days before iPhones and all that kind of stuff and Zoom. So I went over, I had a big aerial photo that showed the rail line, the site, obviously, and the various pieces of it, the highway, MIT, Harvard, and downtown Boston. That was the aerial photo. I walked around Germany and I would walk into a conference room and I put the aerial photo on the table and I say, we're going to buy all this.
And they see, and they know the MIT and Harvard brand, they recognize that.
That was entirely the way it was sold.
You would have been a great broker.
It was sold up an aerial photo. It was not sold up a financial model.
Wow.
And the financial model didn't have anything to do with what actually happened there. So it was like, look, covered land play here, assemble these pieces, option these pieces. There's a bank mall here. We got to buy out all the little tenants. We're going to demol it and put these other tenants in. And we had Christmas tree shops and Bed Bath Beyond and all these different folks that wanted to be in there, all who were viable companies at the time. So there was a big, long, drawn-out process, but it was an infrastructure play. It was an industrial wasteland. It needed to be cleaned up. It was ripe for redevelopment, just like the Seaport was. And you just had to come up with the right scheme. But there were constraints on it. Kmart had a long-term lease, still there, I think. And it was going to require a lot of capital. But basically, where I kind of ended my story over there was assembled all the land, rezoned it with Joe Curtatone, redid the mall to what it is today, developed the main street and the idea of the train station, and then turned it over to, actually Griff sold it for us. And I said, look, we're ready to, the next big round of money is big money to do this. This is billions of dollars of capital. And this is a long-term play. This is a 30, 40 year play. We don't have the right investors to take it that far. So we sold it to Federal Realty. Don Briggs actually was the guy in charge of it. And he did an amazing job.
It's one of the great case studies in land assemblage, and it was super complicated, but I know we're involved in the real estate school at BC, which is the Corcoran Center. They have a great program now, but this is one of the studies they look at is saying, hey, you know, when you talk about assemblage and covered land plays and how this can be a long process, but what happens at the end of it is what you see now when you drive by, which is incredible. And it actually played out. Yeah, you don't know the uses, but you had the realization that this is going to be a long-term phased execution. It's a different type of capital to come in and do that. So it's a great story. It's one of the real estate stories that gets discussed around the market a lot.
One of the last stories I'll tell about that, which is kind of funny, is I was in negotiations with IKEA. There was a lot of stuff going on between the parties, as I said. And it was some of it was quite heated. I won't get into all the details, but I remember a very well-known lawyer in here in Boston, land use lawyer, looks at me and he says, I've never seen anyone negotiate with the two of clubs the way you negotiate. But you still got the two of clubs.
That's a good line.
And I was like, all right.
Oh, that's great. Oh,
I guess he called me on my BS on that one, but it was
well, it worked and you got there. And I think what's awesome is that was the launch. And you know, you think about like these seminal moments, that Four Seasons dinner when they say, okay, we're in, and then the next day when it's we're in. But the outcome has been phenomenal. And I think we want to start talking a little bit about what this led to. If you could talk about from that deal, you formed Taurus, the Taurus that we know. And what was the evolution like? Now you have so much exposure to different asset classes and different geographies. What were the first, call it 5-10 years like, and what were you building the business around?
You know, I kind of thought I was on Easy Street in 1997, where I had all this German money behind me, and here we go. And all I have to do is just ask for the check, and I just got to put my deals in front of people, and the money will come in. And then all of a sudden, you probably don't remember the long-term capital crisis and the Russian ruble crisis of 98. It was a year later.
It's come up in this podcast. We don't remember it, but it's come up here before.
Well, the money stopped, just stopped from Europe. Big devaluation going on, everything else. So I was like, okay, now what? I said, well, I'm just going to go start raising money on my own. Because I don't see why I can't do the same thing here in the U.S. So at the time, I was about to put 160 Federal Street under contract, which is a kind of a mini tower here in Boston. But it's a big deal when you're 31 years old and you don't have any money.
It's still a big deal. It's a big deal for anybody. Yeah, so it's a
and,
big deal.
And so I was like, the only reason why anyone even considered me, what I had to do was find things that were kind of not institutional grade, where I could make them institutional grade. That was always the idea, because otherwise no one would take me seriously. No one would give me a chance. When I bought 22 Battery March Street, which is where we made our office, it was kind of a failed office condo deal, which we dissolved the office condos. And I bought it from the guy, Frank O'Hane, who owned the bar down the street. And he wasn't a real estate guy. He had just bought these condos at foreclosure. And so I was like, look, I got all this crazy German money behind me. I'll pay him more than anybody else. And so I paid him $140 a foot for 22 Battery Bridge Street.
Wow. Good basis.
He thought it was amazing, right? I remember the first deal I did on Newbury Street, I bought from a dentist. I went over to his apartment and his name was Fred Weinstein. I went to see Fred. And he'd up there with his wife. It was like 95 degrees in his apartment. I was melting. And I was like, you know, I really want to buy your building. I'll treat it better than anyone else. Been in the family forever. And he's like, I convinced him to sell me the building. And that was kind of the start of the Newbury Street thing, right?
Because I want to talk about that, too. Yeah, the Newbury Street strategy.
Right. That was the first deal we did on Newbury Street. But anyways, going back to 160, was we were paying $80 million for that building, which, again, was in hindsight, is kind of ridiculous. You know, it was $230 a foot, I think. Lots of cash flow and things like that. But the German money was nowhere to be found. The reason I was able to get control of that was because Meredith and Grew was selling an office condo and a roll-up, but they didn't have the whole thing. They didn't have the top three floors. So again, it wasn't institutional grade at that time, right? So I was like, oh, what do I care about the three floors? I still own 97% of the condo and I control everything, so we'll buy it anyways. We ended up putting that together and Invesco backed us on that. And that was the first kind of big block institutional JV. And then I syndicated some money with some very wealthy families from the Boston area as well. And next thing you know, we have a U.S. business going and we have an institutional JV business. And we'd replace the German flow, which then came back once the market kind of stabilized. But it came back a year later, but we were still able to transact. But what that showed me was that diversifying the capital base was pretty important, because it was going to come and go based on things that had nothing to do with the real estate business.
That's wild. And you said it quickly and you kind of glossed over, but your first institutional LP was Invesco.
Yes.
pretty impressive.
Yeah, yeah.
Your first partner, your first joint venture LP.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a good start.
Yeah, well, actually, there's a reason for that, too, which is that one of the things I also kind of realized, and this is very early days, originally it was just me, and I hired a friend of mine to help execute Assembly Square, one of my classmates from MIT. But then Scott Tully approached me. He was leaving AEW. Scott's one of the smartest guys I know and super credible on the institutional basis. And he's like, hey, I want to join you, and I think you got something going here. And so he did. And he was the one who had the relationships like that. So it was sort of like you got to leverage each other to succeed. You bring different skill sets and contacts to the table. And so Scott was helpful with that first relationship. I probably wouldn't have been able to get it done on my own without Scott. So it's a good point that bringing him in was critical to being able to land Invesco as your first joint venture client.
Yeah. These stories are great for us because there's a lot of great names in here. You know, all these people, we could talk about what they've done in different chapters of their career. But we had John Fish on last week and said success has many mothers and fathers. And there's all different people who enter your career and your business life at different points, and you maintain good relationships, and they come in when, whether it's capital or development partnership or whatever it is, it ends up being a small world. Boston's a relatively small market, but you go from that and then you start growing Taurus around the country. So the relationship game changes a little bit, and Bila Execute, you build the internal team that can go execute time and time again across the platform. So,
yeah. So we started that kind of expansion. What we always had respect for was experts at certain sectors or segments of the market. I'm a generalist. I kind of do everything, but a lot of people are great at very certain things. Like Lathan Allen runs our industrial group, and he's a phenomenal industrial guy. Now, I wouldn't want to put him in charge of our apartment business, but he's phenomenal at industrial.
You got a phenomenal apartment guy in Nick Clark,
we
too,
do.
By the
we
way.
We do. So it's like finding that right talent, right butts, right seats. That's what you got to try to focus your energy on, is aligning that talent, putting them in the right place to succeed. So as we were thinking about expanding the business, it was more about the person than it was about the market or the opportunity. It's still kind of that way. Mm-hmm. If you don't have the right person, it doesn't really matter how good the market is if you don't have the right manager in place. So management matters more than anything else, and alignment of interests and things like that. So finding that right model to have shared success or shared failure, by the way, because not everything works, where people feel the joy and feel the pain if things don't go well or they go really well, that you are going to succeed together and walk down that road together and create strategies and opportunities. So we opened up. We always were kind of active in Florida because the Riblings lived there. So that was an easy one. And we still have a large presence in Central Florida, Tampa and in Orlando, lots of apartments and, and industrial and office. But then our industrial group, we opened up in Atlanta. And that's because that's where Lathan was based. He wanted to build out his team and deploy at scale, and we did. You know, he's built a 20 million square foot subsidiary for us in the U.S. In Munich, that was also a logical choice for us because the Riblings are from Munich, and there was no cultural adjustment for an American trying to do business over there, to try to do deals there and to interact. And actually, it's a very successful part of our business, both capital formation side and real estate wise. We do extremely well in Germany. It's one of our big profit centers. UK was something where I had met some folks over there and I had been spending time over there. And so we opened that up and we did some great deals. And it was kind of the right time. Another name you guys know, Jim McCaffrey, just relocated over there. And we did a bunch of stuff. One very large project that he was involved with financing and selling. And we bought an office building, sort of like a 160 Federal down in the center, 80 million pounds, put 40 million pounds in, sold it for 250 million pounds. It was a great first transaction to do. Very active in Canada with a classmate of mine from MIT, Rob Brown. We were doing retail shopping center stuff up there. We actually ended up selling everything. We exited the market. Finally, we kind of broke into the apartment business, which is in my DNA because that's where I started. For me, the apartment business, one of the great things about that first job being in the rental side was I knew how to value a box, sell a box, get someone to sign a lease. You know how to rent apartments, manage apartments.
You're pulling at our heartstrings because Tommy and I, when we were at BC, we both were rental brokers for apartments. And talk about a good episode that would be is just telling some of those stories. Yeah, I started doing it. Neither of us, when we were renting apartments at first, had ever lived in an apartment, which is great. We had only lived in dorms and we were 19, 20 years old. And you're renting, you know, some of these houses are $6,000 a month for 10 kids, you know, and you're on the phone with someone's dad and he's saying, I'm not going to sign a joint and several guarantee. What are you talking about? And I'm like, sir, I don't even know what that is. I'm 19. I understand you're frustrated, but this is how it works in this market. And we have a lot of great war stories. We both say that around September 1st, we both have trouble sleeping because bracing ourselves for the move-ins, which
that's
used
right.
to come.
That's right. Know? The big wave. Yeah.
But you learn a lot. You know, we learned a ton doing that.
You know what you learn a lot? You learn how to make a commission. You learn how to get someone to sign a lease. It's the same thing whether they're signing a lease for a huge office space or for an apartment. I mean, someone's making a decision to write you a check for that box and they're valuing it. And, you know, if you mispriced it,
it was a great racket. Mike had the good idea of to entice students to choose us as their broker. We'd buy them a keg or an Xbox, one or the other. And they'd think it was the most generous thing in the world. Oh my God, you're going to buy me an Xbox. This is amazing. Or you're going to get us a keg. This is amazing. Little did they know, it's a $300 Xbox, and the commission for these houses is $5,000, $6,000.
So yeah, right.
They're
right.
not doing that math, and they're telling their parents, these are our guys, we're working with them.
Absolutely.
And it was a great model for a while there.
Yeah, it's a good way to learn the business for sure. And then we put Nick in charge of the apartment business. Growing up, you know, we've done, I don't know, 6,000 units or something like that. And,
yeah, I'll just interject. It's been incredible to watch the meteoric rise. And Nick's a friend of Mike and I's, and you two have really built an amazing brand. We just got back from NMHC out in San Diego. Nick was on my 5:30 a.m. flight out Monday, and I'm fresh off a red eye today, so a little exhausted, but you walk around there and Nick is holding court with brokers, with capital, with sellers. He's done a really tremendous job there. So
yeah, you know, there's some headwinds in that business right now, but that's temporary. You got to fight your way through that sometimes in life and business. But again, if you find the right people and you give them the right mandate and you give them the right guidance, and then you develop a culture, which I think my job is more these days, is not so much putting deals together. Sometimes I do it, but not very often. My job is more to lead and to develop a culture of success and to give the guidance for people on what we should and shouldn't be doing and how we should be doing it. And that's really where you evolve to in your career, I think, over time, if you want to grow a business.
Yeah, I think we missed it, but you're the CEO and the owner of the business at this point. So you no longer have your German partners.
Yeah, so that was an inevitable result of an age difference of 20 years. They had been around for a while when I met them. And so I always knew there was going to be that day when they would retire or move on. And so we started planning for that, I'm going to say around 2000. And we had to get through the 08, 09 crisis and then kind of rebuilding everything from there. I'm going to say they started really approaching me seriously about it in like 14, 15. But it was a complicated business by then. We owned a lot of stuff, and the opco was fairly simple. It was a three-way LLC. I mean, same agreement that we had from the beginning, but all the assets and all the various interests that we had around the world, we had to unwind that because we all wanted to have a clean separation so that I could take the business in the direction I wanted to take it in, and they were basically able to fully retire and not have any liabilities or anything like that, which we did. It took us a long time to work it out. They finally exited fully in 2019.
So that kind of launched today's version of Taurus. You've moved into several different asset classes, obviously many geographies, but going back to what we said in the beginning, you've built a platform that's really big. You know, this is over 30 million square feet. You've bought and done $11, $12 billion of deals today. I think you have over $5 billion under management. This is a major platform based in Boston. So sometimes I think sitting here, we don't realize the depth of it. But 2019 on, sort of the modern Taurus, I'll call it, was that an opportunity to business plan and refocus for what this was going to be for the next 10 years, or how'd you approach that?
I had to deal with a lockdown and a COVID crisis almost as soon as we did so we were all excited to do this buyout and then COVID hit. So yeah, it gave us a little time to think, didn't it? Yeah. That was the first crisis that it came across my desk under the new organizational structure. We had plenty of crises before when the three of us were working on it, but this is the first one I had to manage through completely on my own as the owner. So, and it was interesting, you'd have to ask my employees about it, but my guess is that they would probably say that it was a experience in many ways because we dealt with several tragedies that first year. So what happened was one of our key employees passed away in the middle of COVID in May, John Carroll. I would call him, he didn't die from COVID, but I would say that he was a victim. He was waiting for a liver transplant, which did not happen because of the lockdown. He passed away, and he was one of my closest friends. Gunther, my former partner, died of a heart attack, who I just bought out in July, along with his wife, who died at the same time. That's a whole nother story. And then Jim Dermanasian, who you guys probably might remember, he was running leasing and property management for Taurus, died in December. So we had this incredible level of tragedy that hit us during the pandemic. I mean, it was just like the clouds were pretty heavy over Taurus, of this new life of Taurus in the very beginning. What we had to do was manage through the tragedy. Forget about the COVID tragedy and all the stuff that people were dealing with at home and everything else, but just like the true loss of life that we were experiencing as an organization. And it was hard. And what we had to do is I realized I had to kind of bind everybody together somehow, even though we were apart. You couldn't try to do that on Zoom. It just wasn't easy. I'd have people come over in the backyard and I remember when John died, we just all just sat there and kind of looked at each other and we're like, what is happening right now? Couldn't even have a regular funeral and all that kind of thing. It was a very tough start to that next life of Taurus. But what I realized is that sometimes in those difficult times, people get closer together. I felt that. I felt the tightness of the bond of the team coming by managing through all these tragedies together and not falling apart. As people became so tight, my job was to steer them, get them back on track, and to start focusing on the work ahead, which we did. And then kind of got the rally going and picked ourselves up off the floor and we're living to get through it again. And so there were different things that we did strategically in order to get people rebound together again and moving forward. It wasn't easy, but we did that. And it ended up being very positive for us shortly thereafter. And the company grew pretty fast.
Yeah. And we can talk about sort of the business side of this post-COVID. Some of your exposure was end up being good exposure in the real estate markets. But it's a different kind of leadership where you were tested there. I'm sure you had been through crises. You had been through 2008 or the financial crisis, economic crisis. But this was different. Tested a different type of leadership. It's a tightly held, privately held company, and you're at the top. All of a sudden, were there days when you're saying, oh my, were you ever sort of saying, what do I do today to get these people sort of at a point of comfort? And that's three tragedies in a short time span that it must have had you reeling in some ways.
It did. Unfortunately, I've had other tragedies in my life. My sister died at a young age when I was at MIT, and she had cancer. So I've dealt with this in my family in the past. And maybe that was preparing me for dealing with this particular one. Grief is a hard thing, and everyone experiences it differently. And I experienced it one way, and Tiffany or anyone else in the group would experience it some completely different way. But it's one where you have to be respectful of people's processes, and they had individual relationships with these people that were different than my relationship with them. How they were reacting to that and that type of thing, you just had to give them time, give them space. But at the same time, direct the business. The business can't just stop, or it could, but you don't want it to. You want to have it keep moving forward because this is how people make a living. This is how their families are taken care of. They have children. They have bills to pay. You got to keep going. So it was a tough process, but honestly, I think we came out of it stronger than we even were before, tighter as an organization. A high level of respect, I would say, within the organization amongst the peers. And so one of the key things that we did was we named the Employee of the Year award, which we didn't have before, after John Carroll because of the way he inspired everybody in the organization. And that is really a big, very deep emotional process every year that goes through, and it's like taken incredibly seriously and people really focus on it. Again, it's part of like binding the team together. Yeah. You know, those types of things are important. They're intangible, but they're important.
A good case study in leadership that in such a time of tragedy and turmoil in the markets too, you're able to galvanize the group and move forward. And it gets to today, and we want to hear a little about what your focus is today, what types of deals are you looking for in this market. I would love to talk more about the multifamily platform as well and some of your ESG initiatives, the Renew brand. So if you could tell us a little bit about Taurus's focus today, what you think 24 and 25 look like, and what kind of deals people should be thinking of you for.
Look, the company's been growing really fast, and then last year, everything slowed down. We're in the fortunate space that we've always been, last mile, shallow bay industrial people from the very first deal. Mm-hmm. And that's our biggest sector. And we've been highly insulated from everything during this process. We had kind of reduced our exposure to office, particularly urban office, over the years. You know, we used to own dozens of buildings right. in downtown Boston. We sold all of them. Just didn't like the dynamics of heavy TI and leasing costs, et cetera, and it just couldn't really make manufacture cash flow out of them. So abandoned that CBD office product type. It wasn't right for our clients. Then, of course, with the pandemic and everything changed, it was a good thing we had done that. So we don't have a big office presence anymore. We only have a few million square feet of office. It's really largely multifamily on the buy side, multifamily on the development side, and then industrial. Those are our big sectors. And now we're also going into data centers. We have a first project that we're working on in San Jose. And then we have our international operations. We do mostly multifamily development in the UK. We just actually were awarded the UK Project of the Year in for a tower.
Oh, congratulations.
A tower that we built in Manchester. Yeah, the EDA project is amazing. We own a big chunk of downtown Birmingham, where we're also doing about 1,000 units of BTR there. So the UK is an interesting sector in the multifamily space for us. In Germany, we do mostly industrial development, which has been super successful. And then in India, we just finished a million square foot office tower that's anchored by Allianz. That's part of a 5 million square foot master plan site that we're doing. We're about to start on a large condo project, which has already been sold out. We're selling off a hotel site, and then we're doing a mall and another couple million square feet of office.
That's interesting. How are the office fundamentals in India? Clearly, it makes sense to build a million square foot tower. I don't think folks are doing that here. What's different in India?
Demand. Demand's off the chart. There's no supply, and there's this enormous, it's just such a growing economy. The risk you take in emerging markets, and we've done stuff in Turkey and Greece and Central Europe, et cetera, Argentina, is always, it's usually not the real estate or the demographics or anything like that. That story holds together. It's usually the currency related to the geopolitical risk. And India has been fairly stable. So that's been something that's attractive, unlike some of the other places that we've done stuff in, like Argentina and Turkey. We're kind of not going to probably increase our exposure too much in the emerging market space just because of geopolitical volatility. We will be very active in Western Europe and continue to be in the UK and Germany, as we already are, maybe beyond. And then in the U.S., where our focus is really continuing to grow at scale, our shallow bay industrial focus, which we think is the best sector, the most defensible sector, and one that we really have a strong conviction about going forward. And then multifamily, both on the development and the acquisition side, those continue to be growth areas for us. We have created a brand, going into your other question about ESG and those initiatives, called Novo. And we have Novo is our carbon neutral capable apartment living brand. And we use an energy infrastructure company that we created called EcoSmart Solution to devise that and to build out the microgrids associated with that. Taurus started that company in Austin, Texas, a number of years ago. And that's been something that we also think is a big growth vehicle for the business.
And that's the strategy with which you bought your Framingham deal with Kayne Anderson
this
past year.
That's right. And that's 1,040 units in the old Halstead project, which we call the Green now. And so we're doing a decarbonization program there. We just sold Southwinds in Fall River. It had a challenging time, but that was really our flagship. So the EcoSmart flag is both Renew Communities, which is the retrofit business, and EcoSmart, which is the new development microgrid business. And so let's talk about the retrofit business for a second. So what we do is we take some of these older dated projects. That one's workforce housing in Fall River. It was 404 units on a master meter. So you can measure the results of the energy savings that you could do there. So all the energy costs were paid for up by the landlord. So it was about $1 million a year on the P&L. So to the extent you could reduce that $1 million, and if the capital investment was at a certain level, then it would be accretive. So in that particular case, it was a $15 million energy scope that we put in. Air source seat pumps, 1.4 megawatts of solar, all new building envelope, windows, doors, et cetera, insulation, smart appliances, all that kind of thing. We had about $5 million of incentives and tax credits that we were able to secure. So a net cost of around 10, and we were able to reduce the energy cost by $800,000. And then the volatility in energy is gone too. So everyone else's bills are going to be going up like crazy and that particular facility's are not. That 8% return on cost really added a lot of value, and you future-proofed that old project that was needed all this capital anyways for all this infrastructure that was going to fail. So now that's been modernized. And so we think it's like a smart CapEx program that you can do at scale. So we're doing the same thing on the Kayne Anderson joint venture in the Green. We're doing it in a project called Chestnut Place. We're doing stuff in Florida. We're active in Phoenix, doing quite a few projects down there. And they all have a similar theme. It's what our Aegon joint venture does as well. So that's been an interesting product on the retrofit. And we think that's very scalable, both for ourselves. We also offer it as a service to other developers if they're looking to have someone implement that strategy for them. And then on the new build side, going back to that, that all started with a 8,000-home subdivision that we're developing in Austin, Texas. And we decided we had bought this land, 2,000 acres on the east side of Austin, at exactly the wrong time in the market. We bought it in 2006 with the idea that we would just rezone it, master plan it, and sell off chunks of land. And of course, the market seized up in 08 and it was timing was terrible. We decided, well, we're going to develop this now because what choice do we have? How are we going to differentiate it? Well, let's take some of these German renewable energy concepts, European concepts over from Europe to the U.S. and do it in Texas of all places, right? But it was in Austin, so Austin had a more open-minded feel to things like that. What we wanted to do was use geothermal technology to build out microgrids to get to single-digit HERS-rated homes, which are basically net-zero homes, and then sell that value proposition to builders and to homeowners at scale to build out this community. So the entire community will be net-zero. That's using solar and geothermal microgrids.
Just if you could pause there for a second, explain to folks what a sort of microgrid is, because most people have never touched this. Most developers have never gone into, you know, this far. So
yeah, so basically, if you think about you're on a home, your heating and cooling cost is usually, depending on the market, 50% of your energy costs, and the rest is the lights and plugs, just to keep it simple. So the geothermal takes care of the 50%. There's still some electricity cost by running the fans and the pumps, but basically, most of your cost is generated by the loop that goes down about 300 to 400 feet underground, and that temperature differential and with water in that loop and running through a ground source heat pump. You're reducing the demand for the energy with using that loop, which constantly circulates through the, and there's a lot of technology involved, and it's not as simple as I'm making it sound, but it's a lot of design. We have a lot of engineers on staff that work on this stuff, but that's kind of the simplistic look at it. And then the rest of it, the other part of it, you offset with solar. And then you have super efficient insulation and other things like that. But it really isn't a big incremental cost when you do it at scale. So if you do over 100 units in a subdivision, we do 250 units at a time. You get economies of scale and redundancy by building an interconnected loop. So each subdivision has its own loop that we end up retaining ownership of. And then the homeowner pays an access fee to us. So we basically become a renewable energy utility. I can't, wow. It's not really a utility.
Yeah, that's, I'm yeah. Not but you're I'm like not an infrastructure investor at that point.
That's correct. So we invest in the infrastructure. We maintain ownership of the infrastructure. So that's what we've done with, and we're rolling that out at scale.
And those are built for rent or built for sale? Those are built for
we
sale.
We do both.
You do both?
Yeah. Do both, yeah. Yeah, and we do conventional multifamily with it as well. You could do it really for any product type. When you get into high-rise development, you know, you need some ground space to build a loop. So you're not going to be able to do the whole building that way. But for anything suburban, it's really a great solution, particularly in high energy cost markets, because it works in Texas, which is a low energy cost market, although it's a volatile market. But it works really well here. So we're in process of developing. We're permitting 200 units in Concord, Mass. We're going to use this. That'll be a Novo project. So Novo is our EcoSmart solution brand for multifamily. We just finished the first one down in Apopka, Florida. That's about 300 units, one under development in Kansas City, another one in our Austin project, the one in Concord. We have a pipeline of these that we're rolling out throughout the country. We'll be able to do this with our projects, other developers. So if you look at some of these, the reason we got into this was one, I mentioned the project, but two is that energy volatility is a thing, resilience is a thing that people are worried about, particularly in California and other markets like that where the grid is weak. You can get to a much better level of resilience. So when the Texas storms have hit recently, zero impact in our community. We just sail right through that. When everyone else is, people are literally like freezing to death, and we don't have that challenge whatsoever. So it's a more resilient product. It doesn't suffer the same energy cost volatility. You're seeing a lot of energy cost rises, particularly here in Massachusetts. So insulating from that, it checks the ESG box for a lot of institutional investors, particularly from Europe. We have a great deal of interest from those European investors, which we can talk about as well, but that really are signatories to the Paris Accords. They can't invest unless you have a strategy on this. And we can measure against the CRREM pathway the performance of these assets and demonstrate how they're going to comply with the Paris Accord requirements over the next 20 to 40 years. That's all part of the platform that we've created as a separate business. It's kind of a side business to the Taurus business.
I mean, we kind of buried the lead in not bringing this up until now because it's a big part of what you guys are doing, and it's pioneering. We had Maureen Joyce on from Barings, you know, earlier in the year, and she was talking about how, you know, we're going to get to a point where institutional allocators have this as table stakes. Yeah. You need to be thinking this way. You guys are on the very front of the curve in the U.S., but that it takes some passion to do that because this is a big undertaking. What you just said, a lot of folks are going to have to listen to it a couple of times because it's new. But did that sort of DNA come from the German DNA in Taurus, or where did this start become important to you enough that you've created an entire platform around it?
I think at the end of the day, I'm an entrepreneur. You know, I like creating a business and I like challenges and I like things that are interesting and innovative. But I also trust managers and I try to find the best ones as we've talked about in the past. So in the case of EcoSmart and Renew, the idea was sound, but it's really hard to execute. And the market opportunity is big, as Maureen said. We've talked to Maureen about the same thing. She knows about what we're doing. It's sort of like you have a Rubik's Cube. You have to line up all the pieces, the incentives, the energy costs, the rules of the local municipalities, the building codes, BERDO here, for example. Mm-hmm. Some people want passive house. Like, there's lots of different complications because it's a bit of a wild west field right now. Everyone's trying to make up their own solutions. There are federal incentives. There are local mandates. So what we felt is that, and every project is different, every project design is different, that you had to do it in-house. You had to have the right people running this business. Otherwise, you're going to outsource it and you're going to come up with solutions that, you know, you don't understand. It may not make sense. We decided to build out a team to do it. We found the right engineering folks to bring in-house. Now we have 20 energy experts within our 140-person body count. They're not real estate people. I mean, if you meet these folks, they are not real estate people. They are engineers. They are energy analysts and data scientists and things like that. But what they can do, and they're sort of learning, like the real estate guys like Nick and who were very skeptical at the beginning are now saying, oh, they kind of understand the language now. They understand what they're doing. And then the energy guys understand the real estate guys pushing back on different things and then the way the landlord-tenant laws around energy and things like that. So when you have both, you can come up with solutions that actually work for the real estate that are creative. So that's something we think is an advantage that we'll be able to bring to the table going forward.
Yeah, and when the deal team realizes that it returns close to $1 million to NOI every year, you can capitalize that and people get on board.
Yeah, all it is if you think about it, it's just another value add. I call it another arrow in the quiver, right? So everyone's looking for value add strategies. This is a unique value add strategy that's accretive to the return.
When you're exiting these assets, if not now, in 2, 3, 5 years, buyers are certainly going to have ESG boxes to check as well. And they're going to have capital that they need to deploy into assets like that.
They're going to have ESG boxes, but they're also going to be looking at these older dated projects that are 30, 40 years old. And they're going to be like, hey, I got to replace all this infrastructure during my hold period. But we've already done it. And we've done it in a way that can be measured, that we have software packages that will measure the ongoing reporting requirements around ESG and energy consumption, but also will manage the maintenance and the output of these various pieces of infrastructure so that you can also plan for the future when they have to be replaced. You're looking towards the future. You're not just trying to fix up a kitchen and bath. That's easy to do. I mean, it's important to do too, but this is about really taking an infrastructure approach to the real estate.
Now, it's fascinating. As Mike said, it's pioneering. Others are starting to think about things like this, but not to the degree in which you clearly are and not making the investment of resources, of people, of time. So you should be commended for that. And again, it's Mike said, it's enhancing the bottom line. So whether you're checking any boxes or not, it's good for the investment. So
the last thing that's super important about it, as real estate people, we like hard assets, like to be able to see it, touch it. We actually have done the projects now. You can actually see them. You can go down and tour them. You can look at the energy bills. It's proof of concept is real. It's not something modeled on a spreadsheet. That's why it was important for us to exit Southwinds and demonstrate the accretive nature of what we did there. It's why we wanted to continue to develop and complete Novo and complete Whisper Valley in Austin, that big project I mentioned, so that people could go down there and go to our Discovery Center in Austin and understand it and get it. Oh, I'm in this energy center and I see the way this all functions now. I get it now. It's when you see it and touch it, it's much different than looking at it on a set of plans.
I think you're going to have over 5,000 new people who are into this now after listening to the interview, which we don't know where all these people are coming from, but it's legit. And I think that it's enlightening. You know, people are hearing this from you. You guys are a returns focused business and you've put a lot of resources into this and now it's paying dividends. So
we're not doing it as a charity. It is a differentiator. So if you're out raising capital like I do every day, everyone's trying to tell a story and a lot of people tell the same story because it's like, hey, yeah, I'm good at buying apartments or I'm good at buying industrial. But we put this wrapper around everything we do. It's part of our investment committee process, part of our underwriting, it's part of everything. So that is different. That is something that resonates more and more with certain investors.
Yeah. Well, that's a good segue. I think this is not a charity, but you are involved in plenty of those. And it's something we want to talk about because since we got to know you, and early for me was Nick Clark, a young guy when he joined your team. And I think he's a great example of someone that you've empowered. And, you know, he's really helped grow the platform. But I learned a lot about you through Nick. And I just would hear sort of what type of leader and what type of business you were building. One of the things was that you guys were incredibly active in the community. And I think both Taurus as a company and as a platform and your team members, and then you personally, when we talk about things that you've been involved with, Family Reach is a good example. Self-Help Africa, really pushing that into people's purview in a major way. At this point in your life and your career and building the business, sort of where is your focus in that regard? And how did you find those projects that were interesting to you?
Yeah. So when it comes to philanthropy, what I like to do is focus on things that I can have an impact on, not just a monetary impact, but actually a personal impact where I can really focus my energy. So I don't want to be spread too thin. So I'm deeply involved in a few of them. And then I kind of limit my activities to those that I can really be heavily involved in from a board standpoint and then from a financial standpoint. And some of them tie into my personal interests. You know, so the Family Reach thing came out of the death of my sister, left in severe financial hardship, as were my parents, when she died. And she died at a time when significant financial difficulty in the real estate business, as I said, in 1992. So it was really challenging for my family. And so Family Reach focuses on families that are under financial stress due to cancer. And so that's something that's super important to me and my family, and one that I've always been involved in as long as I'm around to advance that. Self-Help Africa is one where I've always loved that cause because think about it, if you're an entrepreneur, what's better than economic empowerment and microfinance in rural communities and bringing people up and trying to help them become self-sustaining economically, basically creating farming cooperatives in these villages in Africa. And that's been something that just kind of resonated with me as something that I find people need access to capital. I needed access to capital. I found it the way I found it. Other people find it other ways. But if you're born in, you know, a remote village in Africa and you're trying to get your farm going and goods to market, you need access to capital. So that's what that enterprise does. And then they become self-sufficient. You move on. There's other things. I'm, you know, a trustee at Sons High School, and something that's also super dear to me is I endowed a fund at Holy Cross and named it after my professor that I mentioned earlier in the conversation around who told me to get into real estate and not to be a lawyer. So there's a famous professor at the school named Ed Callahan. So the Ed Callahan Fund focuses on Irish literature, near and dear to my heart. And I spend a lot of time working on that. And I'm forever indebted to Professor Callahan for the guidance he gave me at a time when I didn't know what the heck I was doing.
We'll have to have a separate podcast to talk about Joyce and Haney and all the greats.
Yeah, exactly.
So an hour on that.
That's right.
Well, yeah. It strikes a chord with us. Our father was, as you know, running the American Ireland Fund in Boston for many years. And the Irish legacy and the real estate market here obviously is strong and very apparent. But I think it's interesting. You go back to your family roots and then your family in Dorchester, your dad being a realtor and home builder in Milton. You took that concept and those lessons applied at a different scale, but, you know, with a lot of those same lessons. And I think the ability to look back and say, there's parts of my family's history that I want to make sure that I support. And then Professor Callahan, in this instance, who impacted your life. I think some people forget to look back. We've had a lot of guests who have given us great examples of people that helped give them a push at a certain time. It's important what you're doing in that regard. And then the same thing, you lift up these families. You think of a farmer trying to get some irrigation going or something going to support the infrastructure to make a living in a village in Africa, someone that can never help Peter Merrigan. I think that's what's all about, helping people that can never help you. Right. But when you go down one generation, two generations, it ends up being thousands of people whose lives are impacted by that generosity and that support.
Like I said, it's all about impact. It's the same thing with Family Reach, where Family Reach is an incredible organization. And the impact that they have on these families and keeping them out of poverty, keep them on their medications so that they don't have a different outcome of their cancer diagnosis than someone who has a lot of money does, just because they can't pay for different things. It's just a fundamental unfairness in our system. And trying to address that is also something that can have real meaningful impact directly to people. So that's its heritage, its impact, its things like that. I think those are important. All four of my grandparents were born in Ireland. Not going to find any other blood in my bloodstream than Irish. So it's important for me to be connected to that country. And that's also same thing. It's kind of heritage, impact, et cetera.
Yeah. It's one of the things we've learned and we've heard in these conversations is it's fairly easy if you have financial resources to write a check, but it's the entrepreneurs who go in and help and roll up their sleeves and go deep into what they're supporting. That's where you make the biggest impact and ultimately where you get the most out of it as a giver. That's the most enriching and gratifying part of it.
Yeah, I think that's right. Because there's so many great causes out there. I mean, you can be involved in hundreds and thousands of them, but I think it's the focus of not just, yeah, money's important too, but it's also bringing some skills to the table, some ideas.
Well, you got plenty of those. And we've talked a lot about the business, about Taurus, your past. We've talked about how you give back. We like to explore the human elements of our guests. So would love to hear kind of what Peter Merrigan's doing for fun these days. I've heard a couple of stories about a fishing boondoggle you do up north. I think it's a salmon fishing trip. But what do you do for fun? Are you a skier, fisher, golf?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time in Montana. I've got a place out there. Actually, Griffin, Woody are out there too. I'm there most of the winter. Try to ski 50 days a year. And there's a lot of friends that you guys would know in the real estate business that are out there. That's a big part of our life. We're there in the summer too for fly fishing, et cetera.
So do you want us to come out? I'm tied up next weekend.
Yeah, I got to look at the calendar, but we can make it work.
Sure, I'd play golf and those are, you know, I used to do a lot of other sports, but I might be getting a little too old for that now because I have so many injuries that I can't really do the contact sports anymore like I used to. But basketball was always a huge part of my life. My family tradition of really since my dad's cousins and everyone else, we would play basketball at the Dorchester house and then go down to the Erie pub on Friday nights. We did that they were doing that since my dad was in his 20s. Some of those guys are gone now. Joe Corcoran was part of that group. And all the Corcoran kids, Michael, et cetera. And the generations are kind of moving on. They're still trying to hold it together. It's getting to be harder. I can't play anymore, unfortunately, because of my injuries. But the other thing that's always super important to me, just personally, I'm going over to London on Friday for the Six Nations. I played rugby in college, and I played afterwards for a club called Beacon Hill with some really good players and good guys from around here. Chuck O'Connor was, Michael O'Connor's brother was part of that crew, Kevin Swords. So is that something we do on an annual basis?
People are so passionate about rugby. We just hired a great analyst last year, Mickey Chappell, who's actually a Corcoran. Mickey's a great kid and a very smart analyst. We happened to be in Ireland one year for the Seven Nations or Six Nations was there. Talk about a crazy crowd of people. I mean, the whole city just shuts down and every bar's full. Everybody's having fun. It's a great tradition.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. And we go over there. We were at the World Cup in October in Paris, and then the same group of guys I played with in college. We do it. It's an annual trip. So that's coming up next weekend. We managed to squeeze in a little bit of fun with everything else.
I love it. We're wrapping up. One thing we like to talk about at the end here, you are getting just where you're doing business alone. Like when you were talking about India, and then we moved on to the ESG initiatives, you have a lot on your plate and a lot to keep track of. How are you getting informed every day? Is it by talking to your team? Is it by reading the paper? Are you reading books? There's a lot of information coming at you. How do you manage it all?
Yeah, so I have a really strong president of the company, Eric Reinbout, who is a terrific leader in his own right, and is sort of like the chief operating officer. He's the president. He oversees all operations. He's not a deal guy. He's not even a money raiser, really, but he's all the operations. Everything goes across his desk. And he takes a tremendous amount of burden off of me. We have a general counsel who handles the legal stuff, Mike Brodigan. And Mike is just terrific at keeping me out of trouble and all sorts of different
from another great clan, the Brodigans.
The Brodigans, yep. That's right. And then Nancy Scott is our CFO. She brings an institutional flair. She was a CFO at Landmark Partners, and she knows I don't worry about any of those things. So what they do is they are able to manage all that stuff where only the stuff that really matters comes across my desk. And that makes a big difference. So it saves a lot of time. I can really focus my energies on things that are important to lead the organization forward and not get bogged down in details or disputes or things like that. And then I'd say the other thing is like empowering the right people, people like Nick, the MDs, Nick, Lathan, Sam, there's a lot of them, and having them have clear direction, but then trusting their judgment and then making sure that they know they're spending their time in the right places doing the right things. And I think they are. So I really don't have a lot of trouble with that part of it. I would say where it's challenging in the, it's like managing any of this because you have a great team. Having a great team makes your life a lot easier. And then you just worry about market challenges. So I spend most of my time thinking about that, how the financing market's going to work, how the leasing market's going to work, where do we want to spend our time, where do we want to deploy our capital? Because I know that the execution side of it is going to be pretty seamless. We won't fall down on that.
Well, that's what you hope for. And it's a testament to you as a leader that you built a team that enables you to do so. And I think that's a true test of the right corporate structure and the right culture. So kudos to you for building that for sure.
Thanks.
We want to ask, we love talking about this topic, and you may not have any off the top of your head, but any great live music memories in your lifetime? What are the best live music experiences you've had?
We didn't prep him on this question, so see how he does.
My thinking about music, I don't know if you agree with me or not, but I think that the most pivotal time of developing a taste for music is in middle school. And that what you listen to in middle school is more or less what you're going to listen to for the rest of your life. You may not be exactly the same, but what resonated to you then, it might be different offshoots or developments of it, but if you loved it then, you're going to still love it. So when I was in middle school, the emerging bands at the time were basically U2 and REM. Bob Marley had just passed away. John Bonham had just died. I always loved rock and reggae and punk. I was into the Sex Pistols and Jam and all that stuff. It was all from that era when I was in like 7th grade, 8th grade. You know, I used to go to this used record store in Harvard Square. We could buy records for a doll. It was called Una's Used Record and Experience Clothing. So you could buy used clothing or you could buy
experience
used records.
Clothing. That's great.
So I would go down there and you buy them for a buck. So I have this incredible album collection because I would steal a dollar off my parent, you know, and I'd take the train from Milton into Harvard Square and I'd buy a couple albums. And so I had this great record collection that I'd play. And then the other thing that kind of happened was I went to Holy Cross, and you probably wouldn't know this, but in the 80s, they weren't really doing concerts at Boston Garden. They were doing them at the Worcester Centrum. So all the bands played at the Worcester Centrum, which was right down the street from the—
I never realized that.
Yeah. Until they really didn't really change until they built the new garden. But so the 80s, was every single band came through Worcester. So I got to see the Ramones at a movie theater and was doing slam dancing in the mosh pit.
I love that.
In downtown Worcester. So that's one good one. Another great one was the Unforgettable Fire Tour with U2 back when those guys must have been in their mid-20s at the time. That was back when rock was really rock and it was fun stuff. So, I mean, I like all kinds of different music now, but those are great memories from those days when you were young and you got to—
Good answers.
Yeah.
Someone on your team had whispered to me, I need to ask about the Taurus Oktoberfest story. It's not involving Tina Turner.
Oh, Tina Turner. Oh, okay. Well, that was me performing, I think. I stood up on the table. That my go-to song is singing Simply the Best from Tina Turner.
Oh, my God. I love it.
On the top of
the
table.
We'll have to get a video link for our listeners to watch.
I think we need to delete any videos on that one.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. Well, Peter, you've been so generous with your time. I think we've taken more than we were given, but we really appreciate it. We congratulate you on the amazing success of Taurus and what you've built. You know, we hope to have you back here, and hopefully our listeners reach out and ask you more questions that we weren't able to get to, but we really appreciate it and your friendship.
I think on behalf of the Newmark platform, we've done a ton of business between our two organizations, but both our team here across the country and hopefully in other parts of the world. But we appreciate that partnership and we want to expand it. So thank you for that. And this has been enlightening for me, and I'm sure it will be for
us. We're going to set you up with our India team. I don't know if we have one, but we get them in the mix.
Well, remember, it all started with Woody and Griffin
Wellesley. That's
so,
right.
You know, I have a lot to thank for the team here. So
awesome. Great way to wrap it up. Thanks so much, Peter.
Thanks, right, Peter.
Thanks a lot.